juice and an in-one protein roll, then ordered a solo car as he rode the elevator down to the street level. A moment after confirming his destination as Chronometric Adventures, the car began to drive itself down Fifth Avenue at an algorithmically safe 17 miles per hour. It crossed town on 52nd, bypassing the Times Square Dome, then made three left turns before stopping on 8th Avenue between West 44th and West 45th Streets. Bert exited the car at the building that had been, in reverse order, the Milford Plaza, the Royal Manhattan Hotel, and in 1939, the Hotel Lincoln. Most of the structure was now a service area for the dome, which it bordered, as well as offices related to the Times Square Authority. Chronometric Adventures was located on floors 9 through 13 of the building, not by choice or convenience, but because of historical flukes and miracles of science. Enough of the building retained the exact architectural lines of its hotel days, and one room in particular, 1114, had miraculously escaped every remodel and renovation since the place opened in 1928. With its dimensions unchanged, the room possessed the volume authenticity needed to echo, with pinpoint accuracy, a ripple in the time-space continuum, an arc intersecting with June 8, 1939. The massive pipes, cables, and plasma grids needed for time travel had been retrofitted to the exterior of what had been the Hotel Lincoln, above, below, and leading into room 1114. The equipment was filled with about a million of the shuffle access digital valve relays invented by Bert Allenberry. He took the lift up to the ninth floor, hearing a feminine voice announce Chronometric Adventures just before the door opened. The company's motto, "The past is important to us," was inscribed on the wall, and under it, Howard Fry was waiting. "Mr. Allenberry, good to see you again." Howard had been the facilitator of every one of Bert's adventures. "I trust you are well?" "Dandy, you?" "Just over a cold. My son brought it home from school." "One advantage of not having kids," Bert said. Cindy had not once said anything about wanting a child. Laudrey before her would have made as horrible a mother as she did a mate. Mary Lynn very much wanted to conceive, but when a doctor told her that Bert's low sperm count made the biology highly unlikely, she looked to other men for satisfaction. She had remarried and quickly popped out two girls and a boy. His first marriage, to Barb, produced a baby girl, but the divorce was so filled with rancor and enmity that the only contacts Bert had with his daughter, once she turned 18, were occasional dinners in London where she lived far too comfortably thanks to his support checks. "Shall we get you to pre-ad?" Howard asked. "Time's a-wastin'." "Funny, but time is actually aplenty," Howard chuckled. In the pre-adventure room, Bert was rechecked by the medical team. His fluids were sampled and scanned, his heart registered, and the 12 other physical properties that are affected by progression, reprogression, were tested. He was given the 5 injections that would bolster his body on the molecular level and the anti-nausea meds to ease those initial moments of 1939. He removed his clothes, as well as his rings, watch, and the thin gold chain he wore around his neck. No items from today could survive the trip to yesterday, as their molecules could irreconcilably screw up the process. Once naked, he put on a robe with the Chronometric Adventures logo and sat through the pro forma legal warnings. First, there was the video, slick and snappy, warning of dangers and explaining the protocols. Then came the reading material, which repeated, word for word, what had just been said. Bert already knew a person could die during reprogression, though no one ever had. An adventurer had options for experiences. One could spend the day doing anything he or she wished, but none when it came to certain key procedures. With his thumbprint, Bert acknowledged, once again, that he understood and agreed to it all. Then Howard came into the pre-ad room with a large shake-like drink that would protect his digestive tract from pesky germs circa 1939. "Bring on the shoe leather, Howard," Bert said, toasting his glass at him. "By now you should be able to recite this to me," said Howard, clearing his throat. As Bert sipped the blueberry-flavored liquid, Howard put into simple terms the conditions Bert had already agreed to. "You have voluntarily chosen to have Chronometric Adventures provide physical time reprogression to this very location on June 8, 1939, for a period of no more and no less than 22 hours as measured by standard recognized time. From the same volume, at 7 p.m. on June 8, 1939, you progress back to this place on this very day. You understand that, don't you?" Bert nodded. "Yep." "Chronometric Adventures in no way claims your holiday in the past is free of risk. Your adventure is governed by the same laws of physics, rules, and behavior as we know to be common. If I fall down, I break a leg, I get punched in the nose, it's broken." "Indeed. You will be unsupervised during those 22 hours. We suggest you adhere to the agenda we have prepared with you. Another day at the World's Fair, yes? You should go yourself, Howard." Howard laughed. "Being African American, 1939 New York doesn't hold the same wonder for me." "I get that," Bert said. On his trips back in time, almost every black face he saw belonged to a porter or a janitor. Though there were black families at the fair taking in the same exhibits, dressed for the occasion, they were looking for promises of a future different from his. "Should you change plans, like seeing a show or loafing in the park, there's no risk as long as you adhere to the protocols for progression." "I'm going back to Flushing Meadows. Maybe next time I'll loaf in the park." Bert thought of spending a day with Carmen in Central Park and wondered how he could pull that off. Virginia could ride the carousel. They could take in the zoo as it originally looked. Ah, yes. Next time. Howard called up Bert's file on his pad. "Mr. Allenberry, I'm afraid you have reached your limit for reprogression at this CA franchise." "What?" Bert still had a third of his shake to finish. "Your numbers from the pre-ad exam were a bit off from your last trip with us," Howard said. "You are showing elevated levels of trillium in your blood and lowered measurements of cellular fluidity." Bert didn't like the sound of that. "Everyone's constitution is different, Mr. Allenberry. In fact, some of our clients have been allowed only two or three of our packages. Six is going to max you out." "Why?" "Molecular dynamics, Mr. Allenberry. The round trip to 1939 is a very long haul for your tissues, your body proteins, your marrow density, and your nerve endings. We can't run the risk of wearing you out. It's hypothetically possible a seventh or even an eighth adventure to the World's Fair would be safe for you, but our insurance model disallows that. That's the bad news." Bert was thinking of Carmen, of Virginia, of the three of them eating pie and visiting Elsie the cow. He would do those things with them just one more time. Bad news, indeed. "The good news," Howard chirped, "is that your chronometric adventures don't have to end in 1939 New York. There's Nashville, 1961. You could go to the Grand Ole Opry. We have a franchise opening in Gunnison, Colorado, a beautiful cabin in 1979. Not much goes on there, but the views are terrific." Bert had stopped drinking. He was thinking of Carmen, of her vanilla lilac scent in her hazel eyes. "I am sorry, Mr. Allenberry, that's the way it is. The past is important to us, but your long life is more so. In that case, I'm going to need something else to take back with me," Bert said. Bert felt the compression suit tighten as all the atoms of room 1114, including his, were jigged up by the mechanics of chronometric adventures. He had learned not to panic during reprogression, but still was not used to how cold it got, so cold that he lost all focus, all equilibrium. He knew he was lying on what would become a bed in 1939, but everything was tumbling. He fought to stay awake, alert, to see the actual process of the room reverting in time, but as before, he passed right out. When he felt a pounding headache, he knew he was in 1939 once again. The headaches were brutal, but mercifully brief. Bert fought his way out of his compression suit, like a scuba diver's, one size too small, and sat naked on the edge of the bed, biding his time until his cranium no longer felt the crash of ball-peen hammers. As before, the double-breasted suit was hanging in the open closet with shoes and socks on the floor. On a thin wire hanger was a button shirt and tie. Undergarments were in a basket on a chair. On the nightstand were the watch, a wedding band, a signet ring, and a wallet that contained his ID and other items that were accurate for the period and made out of pre-World War II materials. There was cash, a total of $50 in the funny-looking paper currency that was once legal tender. There were heavy coins as well, a half dollar imprinted with a lady holding wheat, looking toward the setting sun, and 10-cent pieces, called dimes, with the head of the god Mercury. Nickels were worth 5 cents, and single pennies had real value in 1939. He collected the compression suit and locked it in the vintage suitcase on the luggage stand, hiding it until he'd put it back on for progression. Then he slipped on the vintage watch, already keeping time at 3 minutes after 9 p.m. He put the signet ring on his right hand, but remembered to leave the gold wedding band where it lay. He saw the envelope on the desk, which would have his VIP passes for the fair. He had ordered 3 for this, his last trip to 1939. The window onto 8th Avenue was open just a crack, allowing evening air to come into a room that had yet to know air conditioning, along with the sounds of traffic from Times Square. Bert wanted to get up, to get dressed, and go out into the night, to walk down to East 38th Street where Carmen lived, in an apartment. But his body ached so. Damn the physics. He felt tired, just as before. He lay back on the bed and fell back to sleep just as before. He woke up when dim light was coming through the window and the city was quiet. He felt normal, like he'd taken a green tab and slept a healthy 10 hours. His watch read 7:10. It was the morning of June 8, 1939, and he had all of 12 hours to find Carmen and Virginia. He lifted the heavy telephone receiver, pressed the only button on the phone, and was connected to the hotel operator. Once more, he asked for room service. After the same 5 minutes, a uniformed waiter named Percy was at the door with a tray holding a silver pot of coffee, a pitcher of real cream, cubes of sugar, a glass of water, and the morning edition of the New York Daily Mirror. On 5 previous mornings, Bert had tipped the waiter a dime, prompting a polite response of, "I thank you, Mr. Allenby." This morning, Bert palmed Percy the half-dollar coin, and the man's eyes went wide. "Oh, Mr. Allenby, ain't you flush?" Real cream makes coffee a thick, heavenly pleasure. Bert enjoyed the second cup as the water for his shower heated up. With the plumbing of 1939, this took a few minutes. After his scrub, he dressed. He had been taught how to knot his tie, which he thought was a silly thing to wear, but he loved the double-breasted suit that had been tailored for him nearly a century later. The fabrics were from the period. The socks did not have much elastic in them, and the shoes were like gunboats, wide and heavy, but comfortable. Riding down in the elevator, Bert again smelled the operator's hair tonic. He didn't think it was all that stinky.
"Lobby, sir," the elevator operator said as he opened the meshed grate.
Bert was now familiar with all the smells of the Hotel Lincoln, and he liked them. The cigar smoke mixing with the wool carpets, the flowers being arranged by the black housekeepers, the florid perfume of the well-dressed ladies heading out for their day in Manhattan. Outside on 8th Avenue, taxis idled and buses headed uptown, spewing fumes of combusted gasoline. On foot, Bert turned right out of the lobby and right again on West 45th Street, inhaling the scent of roasted coffee, wafting on a breeze from the Hudson River, from the Maxwell House Coffee Factory in New Jersey, coffee that was good to the last drop. This morning of June 8, 1939, he'd not take breakfast at the Hotel Astor, with its famous clock and its opulent decor. Instead, Bert was going to poke his head into as many nearby coffee shops and cafes as time allowed. Carmen lived only 7 blocks away. What if she was nearby, grabbing a quick breakfast before taking the subway to the Bronx to pick up Virginia? Maybe she was sitting in a Broadway diner right now, having coffee and donuts. He could meet her right then, and not have to wait all day for that moment on the bench by the Four Freedoms. He covered Times Square and the side streets, ducking in and out of cafes and peering through the windows of diners, but there was no sign of her. Reluctantly, he gave up, taking a seat at the counter of a place on 7th, paying 25 cents for a breakfast of eggs, sausage, pancakes, juice, and coffee. Bert was leaving a mercury dime as a tip. "Ma'am," he said to the uniformed waitress with overpainted lips, "is it possible for me to take the subway to the World's Fair?" "Honey," the waitress said, "it's the best way to go." She swept the dime into her apron pocket and gave Bert directions to the IRT line. His first ever trip on the subway cost only an Indian head nickel. The car was a jumble of people who all smelled of something, if only the laundry starch of their freshly pressed clothes. No one was staring at a phone or tablet. Most of the riders read the morning papers, some oversized rectangles of newsprint and ink, others the smaller formatted tabloids. And there were magazines with pages that held more text than pictures. Many people were smoking, even a few men with cigars, and two puffing on pipes. Judging from all the guidebooks and flyers, many passengers were, like Bert, making for the World's Fair. At each stop, Bert stepped off the car just long enough to scan the stations for Carmen and Virginia, because who knows, they could be riding the IRT out to Flushing Meadows. If so, Bert could ask them for directions. They would volunteer to guide him along, since they were going too. He could confess that his 3 VIP passes were burning a hole in his pocket. And why not let him treat the 2 ladies to a hassle-free day of no lines, no waiting? And just like that, what had in the past been less than 2 hours with Carmen would, in the present, become an entire day together. But Carmen never got on the train. "Wow, look at that!" a rider shouted. Out the window were the Trilon and Perisphere. The fair. Bert could see the huge globe and its attendant tower, bright and white in the morning sky. Everyone on the train gave the landmarks a glance. The IRT discharged fairgoers at the Bowling Green Gate, where Bert paid 75 cents for admission and bought a guidebook for a dime. It was only 10:30, so unless fate was to intercede, there were hours before he would see Carmen again. He took a look at the Home Building Center, admired the sofa beds and home furnishings, and found the exhibits in the American Radiator Building just about hilarious. He kept chuckling to himself at the dazzling in those days presentations by RCA, American Telephone and Telegraph, the Communications Building, and the museum-like presentations of the Crosley Radio Corporation. He joined the line for Democracy, the lesson in social studies that was inside the Perisphere. He was soon talking with the Gamelgards,
a family of six, including grandparents, who had taken the train all the way from Topeka, Kansas, to spend a week at the fair. This was their very first day, and Pop-Pop Gamelgard said to Bert, "Young man, never have I dreamed the good Lord would allow me to see such a place as this." Bert was happy to be considered a young man. His $756 billion afforded him every procedure in the world to look much younger than his 61 years. He told the Kansans he had friends in Salina, which prompted an invitation for dinner at the Gamelgards, should Bert ever find himself in Topeka. All morning, he checked out every woman dressed in green, hoping to find Carmen. He toured every building in the Court of Power, the Plaza of Light, and along the Avenue of Labor, where uniformed ladies working for Swift and Company demonstrated the slicing and packaging of fresh bacon. At noon, he blew two nickels on hot dogs at Child's and compared the cut of his double-breasted suit to the fashions to come, according to the prophets of men's apparel. He then walked all the way to the amusements area, heading for the tall iron tower that was the parachute drop. The amusements were the fair's most popular attractions, and the carnival crowd was thick and jumbled. Bert circled the area again and again, stopping at the parachute tower repeatedly, expecting to find Carmen and Virginia as they rose up, 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 and came down ka-joink. But they were never there. So he started one last slow walk around the area and back toward the main fairgrounds. Then he saw her. Not Carmen at first, but Virginia. He was crossing the bridge by the amphitheater, where the Aquacade performed, when a multi-car tram passed him, Virginia sitting on the rail, and yes, Carmen beside her. They had been among the amusement rides after all, and were now en route to the Plaza of Light. Bert checked his wristwatch. If he could catch up with that tram, he'd meet Carmen nearly an hour early. He ran. He kept sight of the tram all along the Avenue of Labor, but lost them at the Schaefer Center on Rainbow Avenue. He just couldn't keep up. The tram continued, passing the Court of States, then stopping at Constitution Mall to empty and take on new passengers. They had to be nearby. Sweating in that double-breasted suit, Bert checked Beechnut, Jewish Palestine, the YMCA, the Temple of Religion, and the Works Progress Administration, but no joy. Resigned to the singularity of the time-space continuum, Bert was pivoting toward the lagoon benches when she appeared right in front of him. Carmen was coming out of Brazil, holding Virginia's hand. They were laughing. Good Lord. The woman laughed so much, and her smile was so adorable. He almost called out her name, but remembered they had yet to meet. So instead, he fell in behind them by a few yards, following them across the walkway over the man-made river that fed the Lagoon of Nations. He didn't trail them into Great Britain, but headed for the bench. A few minutes later, there she was again, with Virginia, right on time. "Excuse me," Bert immediately said, just as Carmen and Virginia were sitting down. "Do you ladies know if the Futurama is running today?" "It is, but the line is very long. We spent all afternoon in the amusements area. What a time we had. Have you rode the parachute, mister?" "I haven't. Should I?" "It's not for the weak-hearted. You go up and up and up. You think you're going to come floating down slow and soft, but you don't. You land ka-joink." "It's true. Have you seen the Futurama?" "We didn't want to wait through that long line." "I certainly don't want to miss it." Bert reached into the breast pocket of his suit. "And I have these special passes." Bert showed them the three heavy cards embossed with the Trilon and Perisphere and the letters VIP. "I'm told these will get us into the Futurama via a secret passage. No waiting. I have three, and I'm alone. Would you like to join me?" "Oh, that's so nice of you, but we are definitely not VIPs." "Believe me, neither am I. Not sure why I even have these. Can we go, Aunt Carmen?" "Oh, I feel like a sneaky Pete, but let's. Thank you so much." "Yes, thanks. My name's Virginia, and this is my Aunt Carmen. Who are you?"
"Bert Allenberry."
"Well, thank you, Mr. Allenberry. We'll see the future with you." The three chatted as they walked the length of Constitution Mall, below the huge statue of George Washington, and around the Trilon and Perisphere. Virginia told of all they had seen at the fair in that day, most of it spent on the rides in the amusement area. "Have you seen Electro, the mechanical man?" Bert asked. "He can add up numbers on his metal hands." The General Motors building was next to that of the Ford Motor Company. Ford showed fairgoers how their automobiles were built, then let them drive a car along a dipsy-doodle of a road around the building. GM took its visitors into the future, first by ascending a long ramp, one so modern they called it a helicline, to a cleft in the architecture so majestic it looked like a gateway into the promised land. The line of people waiting to see Futurama looked to number in the millions. But, flashing their VIP cards at a pretty girl in a GM uniform, Bert, Carmen, and Virginia were taken to a door on the ground level. "I hope you aren't tired," the girl said. "We have a few flights to climb." The machinery of the Futurama bumped and whirred around them. They could hear music coming through the walls, along with a murmur of a narration. "You'll notice the soundtrack matches exactly what you are seeing," the girl explained. "GM is truly proud of the engineering that went into the Futurama. It's absolutely modern." "Are we going to be driving a car?" Virginia asked. "You'll find out." The girl opened a door, revealing the starting point of the ride. Sunlight and people were streaming in through the opening. "Enjoy your stay," the girl said. There were no automobiles, but rather a long train of wheeled, sofa-like carts lined end-to-end, each enclosed in a shell. Passengers were climbing into the shells, which never stopped moving, as the cars passed through the opening of a tunnel. The three intrepid voyagers climbed into one, Virginia first, then Carmen, followed by Bert. Before they knew it, they were in darkness. Music played, and a narrator welcomed them to America, as it would be in the year 1960. The voice was so clear that it was like the announcer was in the car with them. A city appeared before them, a world in miniature that stretched to the horizon. The skyscrapers in the center stood like trophies, some connected to each other by sky bridges. The narrator explained that in just a few decades, American cities would be planned and built to the specifics of perfection. Streets would be clear and ordered. Highways would flow with modern automobiles, GM cars, each of them, with traffic that never cluttered or jammed. The sky would be filled with aircraft carrying goods and passengers to terminals as conveniently placed as filling stations. The country would be scattered with farms, homes, and power stations supplying 1960 with all the food, space, and electricity the American people would need. The houses and towers and cars and trains and planes were filled with a happy, invisible populace that had tamed the wild chaos of the past. They'd figured out not only how to build the future, but how to live in it side by side in peace. Virginia was riveted to her seat as the future rolled by. Carmen smiled at her and looked at Bert. She leaned toward him and whispered, "She'll live there, and she likes what she sees." The words landed on Bert like so many soft kisses. The narration had paused, leaving only the swelling strings of violins and cellos from the musical score. He smelled Carmen's perfume, the soft whiff of lilac mixed with vanilla. Her lips stayed close to his cheek. "Do you think it will all happen?" Carmen asked quietly. "Just like this?" Finding her ear surrounded by the dark curl of her black hair, Bert whispered back, "If it does, it will be wonderful." When they exited, the afternoon shadows had grown longer. As they crossed the bridge of wheels over the Grand Central Parkway, Virginia announced that she would be 30 years old in 1960. "I wish I could jump in a time machine right now and go there." Bert checked his watch. It was 5:56 p.m.,
In the past, he'd been in a taxi by now, on his way back to room 1114. By 7 o'clock, he had undressed, removed all the items that had been provided for his adventure, like the rings and the watch, had squeezed back into his compression suit, and was lying on the precisely placed bed for a progression out of 1939. He should be leaving right now. The taxi stand was just outside the gate, on the other side of Chrysler Motors. Instead, he asked Carmen when the Fountains of Light show was to start.
"Not until dark," she said. "Hey, since you are now in the presence of a couple of VIPs, may I treat you to some pie?"
"I happen to love pie."
"Let's go to Borden's," Virginia said. "We could see Elsie the cow."
Over pie and coffee, he relearned about Carmen and her niece, of the radio club and the roommates on East 38th Street. Everything was just as it had been. Then the past took a turn.
"Do you have anyone special in your life, Mr. Allenberry?"
Bert looked into Carmen's eyes. Framed now in the decor of Borden's food court, they turned an even deeper shade of green.
"She means, are you married?" Virginia teased.
"Virginia?" "I'm sorry, Mr. Allenberry. I don't mean to be forward, but I see you have no wedding ring, and I just thought, well, a fella like you must have someone special."
"I've thought so many times," Bert said wistfully. "I'm forever looking, I guess.
You bachelors are so lucky. You can wait and wait for the right girl to come along, and nobody says boo." She rattled off the names of movie stars and athletes who had yet to marry, names Bert did not recognize. "But us ladies, if we wait too long, well, we become old maids."
"Mama says if you don't find a man soon, there'll be none left for you," Virginia giggled. "You're almost 27.
"You hush," Carmen hissed, reaching over with her fork to stab the best piece of crust, then popping it into her mouth.
"You dirty rat," Virginia laughed.
Dabbing her lips with a napkin, Carmen smiled at Bert.
"It's true. I'm the last hen in the barnyard." "How old are you, Mr. Allenberry?" Virginia asked. "I'm guessing you're like Mr. Lowenstein, my school principal. He's almost 40. Are you 40 yet?"
"Young lady, I'm going to throw you into the Lagoon of Nations." "Mr. Allenberry, I'm sorry. My niece has yet to learn the practice of tact. Maybe by 1960. Bert laughed.
"I'm like your Aunt Carmen, the last rooster in the barnyard. They all laughed at that."
Carmen reached over and took his wrist.
"Aren't we a pair?" she said.
Bert should have excused himself right then. 6 p.m. had passed. If a cab was available, he could be in room 1114 just in time for progression. But this was his last day ever with Carmen. He would never see the woman in the green dress again. Now, Bert Allenberry was a smart man, many say a genius. His invention of the shuffle access digital valve relay had changed the world and garnered him the rapt attention of audiences at conferences full of movers and shakers in Davos, Vienna, Abu Dhabi, and Ketchum, Idaho. He had teams of lawyers obeying his dictates, researchers and developers turning his ideas of whimsy into realities. He had more money than the GNP of most nations of the world, including those where he owned factories. He had donated to very good causes and had his name on buildings he had never even bothered to visit. He had everything a man, a very rich man, was supposed to have, need, or want. Except for time, of course. Chronometric Adventure said he had 22 hours of June 8, 1939, to do whatever he wanted. But now what he wanted was to stay a while. There must be some wiggle room, right? After all, progression, or was it reprogression, he was never sure, could not begin until his body, all his atoms and molecules, were in place in room 1114 of the Hotel Lincoln on 8th Avenue. He understood why Chronometric Adventures demanded such terms. To cover their asses. Why did he have to be in that tight compression suit and on that bed according to the tick of the clock? Was he Cinderella at the ball? Why couldn't he saunter in the room at, say, midnight, then slip into that rubber suit and then whoosh away? What was the big deal?
Have you seen the time capsule? He asked Virginia. I read about it in school. It's buried for the next 5,000 years.
They have what's in it on display in Westinghouse. Electro the robot, too.
You know what television is?
You have to see television.
Bert was rising from the table.
Shall we go to Westinghouse?
Let's. Carmen's eyes were smiling again. The time capsule was loaded with silly stuff. Mickey Mouse comics and cigarettes and whole sets of books printed on microfilm. Though the time capsule and Electro were impressive, television was what had Virginia over the moon. She could see her aunt and Mr. Allenberry on a small screen in black and white, almost like they were stars in a movie. But their images were in miniature, projecting from a screen in a cabinet no bigger than the radio at home. In fact, they were in another room, standing in front of a camera, one unlike any she had ever seen. And they were also in front of her. The vision was thrilling. When they switched places, Virginia waved and spoke into the microphone. This is me, on the television, saying hello from right here, and you can see me right there. Look at you, Carmen said. You look so pretty. So grown up. Oh, Bert, she turned to him. This should be impossible, but here it is. Bert was looking not at Virginia on the screen, but at Carmen. He was thrilled that he was no longer Mr. Allenberry. Checking his watch, Bert saw that it was 7:06. The deadline had passed. The 22 hours were up, and lo and behold, there was wiggle room. They visited the DuPont, Carrier, and Petroleum Industry buildings, none of which had the Sacco exhibits to match television. The glass building, the American Tobacco exhibit, and Continental Baking were just time killers. The longer they lingered in them, the sooner came darkness and the light show. After watching films of water skiers in the Academy of Sports, he bought cups of ice cream, which they ate with little wooden spoons. Here's our spot for the show! Virginia claimed a bench for the three of them. In the growing indigo of the evening, they could see all the way from the lagoon to giant George Washington, silhouetted against the perisphere, surveying the great nation he had sired. As night fell, the buildings of the fair became so many tracings of brightly lit lines on deepening black. The skyscrapers of Manhattan lit up the horizon. The illuminated fairground trees looked to be glowing from within, from their own inner light. Bert Allenberry wanted this night to last forever, for all time. He wanted to sit beside Carmen at the Lagoon of Nations, listening to the murmur of the fair, with her scent of lilac and vanilla stirring the warm air of 1939. When Virginia collected their ice cream cups and took them to the trash bin, Bert and Carmen were alone for the first time ever. He reached for her hand. Carmen, he said, this has been a perfect day. Carmen was looking at him. Oh, those hazel eyes. Not because of Futurama or television. Elsie the cow, Carmen said, her breath catching as she smiled. Would you allow me to give you and Virginia a ride home when the fair closes? Oh, I couldn't do that. My sister lives too deep in the Bronx. We'll take a taxi. Then I can drop you off at your place, on East 38th Street. That would be very kind of you, Bert, Carmen said. Bert wanted to hold Carmen in his arms, to kiss her. Maybe in the back of a taxi on East 38th Street, or in room 1114. Or better yet, on the 100th floor of his building at 909 Fifth Avenue. I'm glad I came to the fair today, Bert smiled, so I could meet you. I'm glad too, Carmen whispered. Her hand never left his. Music began to play from speakers hidden around the Lagoon of Nations. Virginia ran back to the bench just as the fountains shot water into the sky, lights turning the geysers into columns of liquid color.
Every patron of the fair stopped to watch. Projections turned the perisphere into a luminescent ball of clouds.
Wow!
Virginia loved it. Beautiful, Carmen said. The first fireworks broke into the sky, bursting into cascading comets, fading to smoke. That's when Bert felt a ball-peen hammer strike his forehead. His eyes went painfully dry and scratched terribly. His nose and ears started to run with blood. His legs went numb, and his lower back seemed to separate from his hips. A hot, searing pain shot through his chest as the molecules that made up his lungs began to separate. He had the sensation that he was falling. The last words he heard were Virginia yelling, "Mr. Allenberry!" The last thing he saw was the fear in Carmen's hazel eyes.
Gosi Kostas.
Ibrahim had been true to his word. For the price of one bottle of Johnny Walker Red Label, he had provided Hassan with two, most certainly stolen, but that didn't matter to either of them. In those days, American liquor was more valuable than gold, even more valuable than American cigarettes. With both bottles clanking in his knapsack, Hassan, dressed in his nearly new blue pinstripe suit, searched the many tavernas of the port city of Piraeus, looking for the chief of the Barangaria. It was known that the chief savored the taste and effects of Johnny Walker Red Label. It was also known that the Barangaria was taking cargo to America. Hassan found the chief at the Taverna Antholis, trying to enjoy his morning coffee. "I don't need another fireman," he told Hassan. "But I know ships. I speak many languages. I'm good with my hands. And I never brag." Hassan smiled at his little joke. The chief did not. "Ask anyone on the Despotico." The chief waved to the waiter boy for another coffee. "You are not Greek," he said to Hassan. "Bulgarian," Hassan told him. "What is this accent of yours?" During the war, the chief had done a lot of business with Bulgarians, but this one talked in an odd cadence.
"I'm from the mountains."
Pomak?
Is that a bad thing?"
The chief shook his head.
"No. Pomaks are quiet and tough.
The war was hard on the Pomaks."
"The war was hard on everyone," Hassan said.
The boy brought the chief his other coffee.
"How long have you been on the Despotico?" the chief asked.
6 months now." "You want me to hire you so you can jump ship in America?"
The chief was no idiot.
"I want you to hire me because you have the oil fuel. A fireman checks the bubble in the tube is all. He doesn't shovel the coal. Too long with a shovel and it becomes all a man knows."
The chief lit a cigarette without offering one to Hassan.
"I don't need another fireman."
Hassan reached into the knapsack between his feet, pulled out a bottle of Johnny Walker Red Label in each fist, then set them on the table beside the chief's morning coffee.
"Here. I am tired of carrying these around."
3 days out, some of the crew began giving the chief troubles. The Cypriot steward had a bad leg and didn't clean up after meals fast enough. The seaman Sorianos was a liar, saying he had checked the scuppers when he had not checked the scuppers. Yason Kalimaris's wife had left him again, so his hot head was even faster to flare. Every conversation with him turned into an argument, even over dominoes. Hassan, though, caused no worries. He was never idle with a smoke in his lips, but was always wiping down valves or taking a wire brush to the rust. He played cards and dominoes quietly. And perhaps best of all, he stayed away from the eyes of the captain. The captain noticed everything the chief knew, but he did not notice Hassan. Past Gibraltar, the ship met the heavy seas of the Atlantic. At sea, the chief rose early every morning to wander the Barangaria looking for possible headaches. This day, as usual, he climbed up to the bridge for the coffee that was always there, then worked his way down. he found all was well until he came to the fuel station and heard Bulgarian being spoken. Hassan was on his knees, rubbing the legs of a man leaning on the bulkhead, a man black with oily grime, his damp clothes sticking to his skin.
I can walk now. Let me stretch, the filthy man said, taking wobbly steps back and forth on the steel deck.
He, too, spoke Bulgarian.
Ah, feels good.
The man drank deep from a bottle of water, then wolfed down a thick slice of bread from a wrapped bandana.
We are in the ocean now, Hassan said. I could feel it, the ship rocking.
The man finished the bread and drank more water.
How much longer?
10 days, maybe.
I hope it's less.
You'd better go back in, said Hassan. Here, your can.
Hassan handed him an empty tin that once held biscuits, taking from the filthy man a can that was once for coffee, but was now, the chief could smell, filled with sewage. Hassan covered the tin with a bandana, and then handed over a corked bottle of water, and the filthy man crawled back into a hole, a narrow gap in the decking, from where a plate had been lifted. With some struggle, the filthy man squeezed through and was gone. Hassan used a bar to lift and slide the steel plate back into place, like a puzzle piece.
The chief did not report what he saw to the captain. Instead, he went back to his cabin and looked at the Johnny Walker red label. 2 bottles. 1 for Hassan. The other for his friend hiding in the half meter of space between the steel decking. On ships heading to America, stowaways were not uncommon, and life was easier if eyes saw nothing, and questions were not asked. Of course, sometimes a full coffin was offloaded as a result. Ah, the world was a mess. But it seemed a little less messy after a drink from the first open bottle. If someone else discovered the filthy man crawling around in the black space between decks, there would be hell to pay, plus all the paperwork for the captain. It was up to Hassan. If the captain never found out, well, he would never find out. 2 storms at sea slowed down the Berengaria. Then the ship had to wait 2 days at anchor until a harbor pilot finally came out in the little boat, climbed up the pilot ladder, and made his way to the bridge to guide the ship into port. It was night by the time she was tied up at the dock, 1 ship of so many. The chief saw Hassan at the rail, looking at the skyline of a city in the distance. That is Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. America.
Where is Chicago? Asked the Bulgarian.
Farther from Philadelphia than Cairo is from Athens.
So far. Son of a gun.
Philadelphia looks like paradise, eh? But when we dock in New York, New York, you will see a real American city.
Hassan lit a smoke, offering one to the chief.
Better cigarettes in America.
The chief smoked, eyeing the Bulgarian, who had caused no problems for him, not a single one.
Tomorrow they search the ship.
Who?
American big shots. They search the ship high and low, looking for stowaways, communists. At the mention of communists, Hassan spit over the rail.
They count heads, the chief continued. If the numbers don't match up, it's trouble. If they find nothing, we offload and then go to New York, New York.
I will take you for a shave there. Better than the Turks can shave.
Hassan said nothing for a moment.
If there are communists on this ship, I hope they find them, he said, spitting over the rail again.
Hassan lay in his rack faking sleep as the other crewmen came and went. At 4 a.m., he dressed quietly and slipped into the passageway, checking around each corner to make sure he was not seen. He made his way to the fuel station and used the iron bar to lift 1 plate of the steel decking and slide it open.
It's now, Hassan said.
Ibrahim crawled up from below, his elbows and knees rubbed raw and bleeding from living in the low, dark space between the deck and the ship's inner hull. How long had he been down there? 18 days? 20? Did it matter?
Let me get my can, Ibrahim whispered in a croak. Leave it. We go, now. A second, please, Hassan. My legs.
Hassan massaged Ibrahim's legs for as long as he dared, then helped his friend to stand. Ibrahim had been on his feet only a few minutes each day. His back ached horribly, and his knees were actually shaking.
We have to go, Hassan said. Follow me by 2 meters. We wait at every corner. If you hear me speak to someone, hide where you can.
Ibrahim nodded, taking small steps, following. A ladder led to a hatch that led to a room that led to another hatch and another passageway and another ladder. At the top of it, another passageway and one more ladder, though this was more like a stairway. Hassan pulled on a heavy steel door that opened inward and halted. Ibrahim smelled fresh air for the first time in 21 days. That's how long it had been since the Berengaria had left Piraeus, with Ibrahim hiding under the steel decking.
It's okay, Hassan whispered.
Ibrahim stepped through the doorway and was finally outside. The night a blessing. His eyes tried to adjust. The air was warm, the air of summertime. They were at the portside rail facing away from the dock, the water 12 meters below. Hours earlier, the ship's Pomak firemen had tied a rope, anonymous as any on deck, to the lowest rung of the rail.
Climb down, swim around to the dock and find a way up.
I hope I can still swim, Ibrahim said. He was laughing like it was a funny joke.
There are bushes nearby. Hide in them until I come tomorrow. What if there are dogs? Make friends with them.
That made Ibrahim laugh again as he swung over the rail, the rope in his hands. The chief was with the captain on the starboard wing of the pilot house, taking their morning coffee. The longshoremen had offloaded most of the cargo, and the docks were busy with trucks and cranes and workers.
"We'll go to the Waldorf Hotel,"
the captain said, just as the chief saw Hassan walking down the gangway and off the ship, with his knapsack that once held bottles of Johnny Walker Red Label. He was carrying, too, a parcel under his arm. Crewmen returned to the ship with parcels, filled with goods they could buy only in America, under their arms. But here, Hassan was leaving with one.
Big steaks like this,
the captain held up his fingers, showing the thickness of what his steak would be.
The Waldorf Astoria Hotel, they have the steaks.
That's a good place, the chief said, as Hassan disappeared into some bushes. Hassan found no sign of Ibrahim, and was worried that American big shots had searched the bushes for communists and uncounted heads with no papers. Not wanting to call out, he howled like a dog. He heard a dog howl back, but it was Ibrahim, who came out of the bushes, stripped to the waist and carrying his grease-caked shoes.
"Who's a big dog?" he asked, smiling.
"Were you all right through the night?"
"I made a bed of reeds," Ibrahim said. Soft, and the night never got a chill.
Hassan opened the parcel, showing some clothes and soap and food and a shaving kit. There was also a folded newspaper bound in twine. Inside was Ibrahim's share of the drachmas the two had saved from all the odd jobs they had worked in Greece. Ibrahim pocketed the bills without counting.
"How much will a train cost to get to Chicago, Hassan?"
"How much from Athens to Cairo?
Find a money changer at the train station."
After Ibrahim had eaten and washed, Hassan sat him down on a rock and took the razor to his face, shaving his friend, as there was no mirror for him to do it himself. From the bridge wing, the chief searched the bushes through a pair of glasses. In a gap between waving branches, he saw Hassan shaving the face of a man he could not recognize. A problem had left the ship without bothering the captain.
No need for a coffin, either. The son was one smart pomak. As Ibrahim ran a comb through his wet hair, Hassan tried to clean his friend's shoes.
"The best I can do," he said, handing them over.
Ibrahim reached into his pocket and pulled out a single drachma and slapped it into Hassan's hands.
"Here.
A perfect shine on perfect shoes." Hassan took a bow, and both men laughed. They walked together to the end of the dockyards, able to mingle with others coming and going. They saw huge cars, trucks the size of houses grinding gears and pulling big loads, and more ships, some much larger and newer than the Berengaria, others rusted buckets. They saw men eating rolls with sausages in them at a kiosk with a sign Hassan could spell out. He had been learning the American letters, HOTDOGS. Both Bulgarians were hungry, but neither had American money. At the end of the dockyards, there was a gate with a guard in an office, but every American walked past without so much as a pause.
"Hassan, I will see you in Chicago one day," Ibrahim said. Then in English he said, "Thank you very much."
"All I did was carry your shit away," Hassan said, taking one cigarette, then giving the pack to Ibrahim. He smoked it while watching his friend walk to the gate, pass the guard with only a nod, and disappear down the road toward the skyline of Philadelphia. Returning to the ship, Hassan kept busy all morning, not getting to the galley until the first meal was nearly over, and only a few of the crew were around. He collected what bread, vegetables, and soup was still available and sat at a table. The Cypriot with the limp brought him a coffee from the galley.
"America for the first time?" he asked Hassan.
"Yeah."
"America is the top, I tell you. New York, New York has anything you want. Wait until you see."
"The big shots. When do they come on board?" Hassan asked.
"What big shots?"
"The Americans who search the ship, looking for Reds, making big trouble."
"The fuck you talking about?"
"They make sure our heads match, the chief told me. Big shots come and search the whole ship."
"Said for what?"
The Cypriot went back to the galley for a coffee for himself.
"They check our papers, right? Line us up and check our papers?"
Hassan had lined up so many times to have his papers checked, it made sense that he'd do the same in America.
"The captain takes care of that shit."
The Cypriot downed half of his coffee.
"Hey, I know a whorehouse in New York City. Bring money tomorrow, and I'll get us laid."
Back in his village, Hassan had seen black and white movies flickering on a white wall. Sometimes the movies were American, with cowboys on horses shooting pistols that threw out long plumes of smoke. He liked best a newsreel that showed factories and construction sites and a new building rising to the sky in a city called Chicago. Chicago had many tall buildings and streets jammed with black sedans. But New York, New York, looked like a city with no end. A city that threw a haze into the night sky, making the low clouds golden and the water shimmer like colored smoke. A hot wind blew as the ship moved slowly up the wide river, the city passing like a brilliant jeweled curtain, a solid mass of a million lighted windows, bright towers shining like castles, and twin lights of cars, so many cars, buzzing every which way like insects. Hassan stood at the rail, the wind rippling his clothes, his mouth open, his eyes wide.
"Son of a gun," he said, "to New York, New York."
In the morning, the chief found him at the fuel station.
"Hassan, put on that striped suit of yours. I want to shave." "I have duties here." "I say you don't. And I'm the chief. Let's go. And leave your money here so you don't get pickpocketed on your first day."
Cars flew down the streets, many of them colored yellow with words printed on their sides, screeching to stops at corners as people got out and different people got in. Lights in boxes mounted on poles flashed red, then green, then orange again and again. Signs were everywhere, attached to poles,